Good morning and welcome to The Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Sean Freeman.
Hello, good morning.
And once again, we are the boys that work at the Binary Research Institute, where we look at this very ancient idea that there's a cycle of time with alternating dark and golden ages, which Plato called the Great Year. And according to many writers on the subject, most importantly, Giorgio De Santayana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT, over 30 ancient cultures believed in this cycle and tied it to the motion of the heavens, one precession of the equinox. And as our regular listeners know, we are looking for possible evidence that might support this notion that the ancients did have great knowledge before the Dark Ages. And so in that tone, we investigate various scientists, archaeologists, anthropologists, engineers that might have come up with something to show the wisdom of the ancients. And one of the most powerful bits of evidence that I've seen in recent years is the work of Chris Dunn. And Chris Dunn is our guest today, and he'll be talking about his work and the amazing accomplishments of the ancient Egyptians. So are you on the line there, Chris?
Yes. Hi, Walter. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show. I've read so much about your recent book, and I want to just, you know, get into the questions right away because I think many of our listeners are already a bit familiar with you. First of all, can you just tell me a little bit about your background and how you originally became aware of the thought that the Great Pyramid might be something other than a tomb to burrow a dead king in?
Yes, certainly. Well, my background has been in manufacturing. I started at a very early age as an apprentice and actually worked my way up into the C-suite, or at least upper management, with an aerospace manufacturing company currently in Illinois. But I started out on the shop floor as a lad in Manchester, England, in an engineering company called Mather & Platts. But it's been a process of a really hands-on kind of experience along with education and at technical college, and then basically on-the-job experience that has led me from doing simple things with simple hand tools to very complex tasks using very sophisticated machine tools such as high-powered lasers with computer numerical controls. Also moving on to the design and programming of the machine tools, and then eventually into management. So the it's been almost a 50-year process for me, and it's been a very, very, I would say, educational process in terms of how things are actually created, an appreciation for what we have in terms of the machines that we use. Such a, I mean, even a simple machine, well, we call it simple, but it's really a complex machine. We may think it's simple, but say a cell phone is a complex machine, but we take it for granted. The switch on the wall we take for granted, but it's essentially something that commands machines to do their work and deliver energy to our homes. So the appreciation for technology I brought with me to Egypt when I started to study the pyramids in 1977, and as I was studying the Great Pyramid, particularly with the schematics or the drawings or the blueprints that were available in Peter Tompkins' book, Secret of the Great Pyramid, it was something that kind of struck a chord with me because it presented information that was not available to me when I was in school, or at least it wasn't really discussed. What was discussed was that the pyramid was a tomb for a king, and let's move on to something else. But the amazing details within not just the Great Pyramid, but all the pyramids, really speak of a much higher level of technology that what has been taught. And so I recognize the marks of the tools that were actually applied to very, very highly precise granite blocks and the limestone that went into building the pyramids. And it's it really speaks of a civilization that had an incredible civilization that had risen way beyond what we have given them credit for.
Now, was that sort of your first aha when you realized that these marks can't just be made with chisels?
It was, and it was a real surprise to me. And it was just the description in Tompkins' book led me to William Flinders Petrie. Because as I was reading Tompkins' book, he referenced Petrie's work, and I went out in search of the books that Petrie wrote, and Pyramids and Temples of Giza, which is became very, very popular, presented an architect's, or not an architect, but a surveyor's point of view. But Sir William Flinders Petrie was the first British Egyptologist. And he studied in Egypt in the 1880s, but he wrote like a technical person. I mean, his work is very, very it resonates with the engineering mind, because it's very powerful, it's very factual, and it described objects that you normally don't read in. Or you don't see on the Discovery Channel, or you don't read in the normal Egyptologist books, but some of the little things that he would discuss.
Well, mention one or two for us, would you?
Okay, I'll mention this one that eventually became the centerpiece in an article that I have published in 1984, and this particular artifact was a simple round piece of granite. It was a core that came out of a hole. And the way the ancient Egyptians drilled into their granite, they used something that is like a hole saw, what we would consider to be a hole saw, or something like a cookie cutter that you would trepan around and remove the centerpiece, and then what you had left is the hole. Well, the hole was what the objective, and the centerpiece of the core was discarded. And Petrie picked up one of these granite cores in the tip, or the trash heap that was near the Great Pyramid. Well, he brought it back to England. He studied it. He brought engineers in to study it with him. And he was absolutely baffled by what this small, seemingly insignificant core presented to him. And that was a groove, or a spiral groove, that wrapped around this piece of granite that indicated that whatever had cut it had cut at a phenomenal feed rate. And that feed rate he described to be 100 thousandths per revolution of the drill. Well, anybody who has done any drilling, whether it's in aluminum, steel, or stone, knows that 100 thousandths per revolution of a drill is a phenomenal feed rate. In fact, it's an impossible feed rate in granite using conventional means. And so I puzzled over this particular piece for quite a long time, and the only conclusion I could come up with was that it was cut using some kind of a vibratory action. In other words, the tool was vibrating vertically or up and down and oscillating and cutting the granite in an abrasive way, and then it was pushed into the granite or rotated radially and causing the feed lines in the granite on the hole and the core. And the remarkable thing is that even going to Egypt now and going to places like the Valley Temple, where this core supposedly, allegedly came from, you can see the holes and you can see the grooves in the holes. Also at Abu Ghraib, Abu Sir, you find similar holes with these feed lines in them. Well, the article I wrote, of course, it was published in Analog Science Fiction Science Fact in 1984, and it was entitled Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. And it dealt with what Petrie described, not just this particular core, but also some other artifacts. That article, for anybody who's interested, is available on my website at gizapower.com.
Okay, great.
And they can read that there. It became very, very controversial, and I started to debate it back in 1995 after I first got wired to the internet, and I debated it on Deja News. And of course, I have discussed it numerous times on message boards since then. So it's quite a controversial piece.
Right, and how would the traditional Egyptologists explain something like that?
Well, that's the interesting thing about it, is because I based my article on Petrie's observations, and then somebody comes along and said, well, they had found this core. I hadn't physically seen the core. But somebody, it was a couple of guys, John Reed, I think, and a stone cutter in England, had actually located the core in the Petrie Museum in London. And a book was published back in 1999. It was entitled Giza the Truth. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that was Chris Ogilvy Herald and Ian Lawson, mm-hmm. the authors of that work. And they, in their book, they essentially dismissed my observations based on John Reed and Harry Brownlee, the guy's name was, who had been to the museum and declared it to be a horizontal groove and not a spiral groove. And that was the key. The spiral on the core is the key to the method used. And if it was horizontal, then simple methods could be described.
Well, that should be easy enough to prove.
Well, yeah, and that's what I did. I must confess I was caught a little flat-footed, so I immediately bought a ticket to fly to London and went to visit the Petrie Museum to check whether it was indeed a spiral, whether it was horizontal, because I suspected that they had photographed the core at the wrong orientation. It was kind of tilted over a little bit, and so it could appear to be horizontal if you didn't actually write the piece so that
sure.
The taper was equal on both sides. So I used a very simple method. I used a white cotton thread and went to the museum. The people at the museum were very accommodating, very kind.
And you just put the thread in the groove?
And I just put the thread in the groove and put a bit of scotch tape on it to hold it down, and then started to feed it along in the groove and rotated the core to see where it ended up when I had gone around 360 degrees. And guess what? It was a spiral, and it kept on spiraling down the core.
And that's the strongest evidence you can get. I mean, that's That's so awesome.
Well, it's a really remarkable piece, and that's not the end of the story, unfortunately, or fortunately, because it gets even more interesting, this whole saga of the Petri Corps. There was another fellow, his name was Dennis Starks, who had demonstrated that you could actually grind a hole in granite using a copper tube and some quartz sand. And so he was able to demonstrate that he could knock out a core, and essentially that has been held up by conventional theorists and Egyptologists as the true method that the ancient Egyptians used.
Does that give you the radial or the screw type of pattern?
Well, that's the interesting thing, and that's a very, very good question. It doesn't. But the only way I could find out, because I tried to communicate with Dennis Starks and try to find out about the whether his groove was spiral, he maintained in his article that it was horizontal and similar to the Egyptian cores. In my communication with him, I asked to see a good photograph of it, but essentially I was told that I better just make one myself, which I did eventually. And looking at my results and having handled the Petri core and having close-ups of it, I can tell you without any equivocation that was not the method that the ancient Egyptians used. But the other part of it is, which I reveal in my book next, which comes out next year, The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, it's not the method that I described in the Giza power plant, my first book, or advanced machining in ancient Egypt, which I indicated or speculated that it may have been some form of ultrasonic machining. They were using something entirely different, in my opinion, now. Because one of the other things that I was able to accomplish, I had contacted the curator and asked him if I could have a latex impression of the core made.
Oh, yeah.
So that I could unfold it and be able to display it in 2D, so that they would have the reader or the researcher who was interested in this subject would be able to see the entire surface, not just one side of it.
Any luck? Were you able to get the latex?
Yes, I got the latex, and I was able. The process I used was along the length of it. I cut two square holes, and those square holes actually oriented the piece in my graphics program on the computer after I split it.
Mm-hmm.
And I split it between the two square holes, and then I essentially laid it flat, and what you have is two notches, one on each side, and able to photograph it, get it in my graphics program, and draw a line between the square notches and then be able to display clearly to interested people that it was indeed a true spiral.
Outstanding.
But it's amazing, though, the refusal to accept even, you know, my use of the cotton thread, which I thought was a, you know, a foolproof way of inspecting it.
Yeah,
it seems
obvious to me, but that's the bias out there, you know, when something flies in the face of the theory that 95% of the people accept right now, they're just not going to accept a counter theory, no matter how much proof there might be for it, but that's life. Anyway, we're speaking with Chris Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt. You're listening to Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden here with Sean Freeman. We're talking with Chris Dunn about some of his work in investigating ancient Egypt, particularly the Great Pyramid and the technology that was used to develop this complex. And Chris, we just talked about how even though you can prove something in black and white, that this hole had to be radially cut and this was not a technology available to the ancient Egyptians, this was not accepted by the people that had criticized you for your work. What's been the follow-up to that? What have the critics said to you since, or have they just gone silent?
Well, I've gone silent, actually. I have been doing my homework and making sure that I have all my T's crossed and, my I's dotted. And in the process, my I's are crossed. But the what I have is I just provide better evidence. And, you have to just start collecting more evidence, better evidence, and then present it again. What I was left with in terms of what I needed to do after the criticism was to, number one, get a latex peel or a latex impression of the core, and then present that. And I also had to cut my own core. The reason why I had to do that was to determine for myself, or at least to have something that I could show the reader how sand and a copper tube, how it will affect granite. And the evidence is very, very clear. It does not create an ancient Egyptian core the way the ancient Egyptians did it. And the hole does not look like ancient Egyptian holes.
Right. If the signature is different than the authorized, it's
absolutely
different.
Absolutely different. Right. And as a craftsman and as an engineer, I knew that before I went into this. I mean, it seemed I didn't even address the sand and copper tube theory because I knew it would not work. That I didn't think people would actually believe that it would replicate the ancient Egyptian workmanship. But unfortunately, not everybody has the kind of background that I have, and so they go with the Occam's razor, they call it, where the simplest of all things being equal is probably the right solution to the problem, where unfortunately, the simplest method doesn't explain the evidence, so we have to move to more complex answers to explain the evidence.
Right. I think it was Einstein that said we should always choose the simplest answer, unless that fails to answer the question.
Yeah.
In which case, we need a...
Yeah, so, Occam's razor, it doesn't mean that you stay with the simplest answer, because it may not be the right answer.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So then understanding that the evidence that you were seeing did not fit sort of a primitive technology, but spoke more of a more advanced technology. How do you get from there to realizing the Great Pyramid as a power plant? There's got to be a few steps in between.
Yes, there was a lot of steps in between. When we look at the Great Pyramid, and a lot of people like us have studied the Great Pyramid, and on a intuitive level, we tend to say, there was something going on back then that is not explained in the conventional literature. That was the conclusion that I came to. And the Great Pyramid has always been a great subject for people to kind of knock their brains against and try to come up with solutions. Traditionally, over the years, there have been many people who have gone to the pyramid and dismissed the tomb theory and tried to come up with some alternate theory on what it was used for. And I'm no different. I did the same thing. The task I set for myself, though, was that I had to be able to explain all the evidence. All the evidence would have to fit into the theory, and with no evidence being left out or not having an explanation.
And so the evidence really is then the constraints for whatever argument you come up with. And I imagine one of the biggest constraints is, why the heck did a civilization spend so much time building such a massive structure?
Well, that question is the precise, exact question that I started with. The whole subject is framed within that one single question that you just articulated. And the answer that I came up with was that they would not invest so much time and effort in doing that if they didn't expect something really significant out of it. Now, of course, you know, the argument on the other side is that, well, ancient cultures went to extraordinary lengths to please their rulers, worship their gods, and everything is kind of couched in this whole symbolism or whatever the gods wanted, whatever the king or the pharaohs wanted, that's what they got. And so for me, I look at that argument and I think, well, you know, that is true. There's no argument against that. But when you look at the Great Pyramid and you look at the stated purpose that it was supposed to be a tomb for a king, it falls apart when you begin to examine the inner chambers and ask more questions.
Yeah, isn't it true that there actually has been no evidence of mummies or any kind of a body found within the pyramid?
It's true. There have been no original burials found in any pyramid. Now,
hold that thought for a moment. We're speaking with Chris Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant. We'll be right back. Chris, you were saying there's been no actual mummy found within the Great Pyramid.
There's been no mummy found within the Great Pyramid. There were mummies found in other pyramids, but they were not original burials to the pyramid. There have been no intact original burials found in any pyramid in Egypt, none. And when you look at the design of the pyramids, I can understand why. For engineers and architects, there's a string of them that have come forward and said, you know, we can't build the Great Pyramid today, even with the technology that we have. So how did they do it 5,000 years ago or how many thousand years ago? How did they do it then? And on the other side, the academics, the Egyptologists, will pull out a few copper chisels and a wooden sled and say, here, these are the tools that built the Great Pyramid. And so it seems like we're talking past each other. We're not listening to the Egyptologists, and they're not listening to the engineers. And I don't know. I don't know how to overcome that, or whether I even want to overcome that.
Or if we can, as long as this belief that the ancients couldn't have built such a structure, you know, this belief that anything before us must be more primitive is so strong that makes it difficult for people to accept the wider argument.
It does. And the as a part of the argument is this, the fallacy of circular reasoning, because, well, they had to have... of course they knew how to build the pyramid, because there's the pyramid. And, of course, they use simple tools, because that's all we have found in the within the archaeological evidence. And so, regardless of whether we can make it or not, they could.
Yeah, that's the second, of course, we have trouble with.
And there's, you know, some people actually invoke magical powers, you know, or they will say, well, time was not an issue for the ancient Egyptians. You know, you've heard the saying, an Egyptian minute, which sometimes lasts a lifetime. But the and so they had a different concept of time. And that's another argument that I address, because there are, in the creation of any artifact, time is an issue.
Well, and there's a whole political administrative issue there too. If they use the argument, well, they build it for a particularly strong leader, and mm-hmm. and yet you come, then they argue that they had all the time in the world, you know, and that time takes more than a lifetime. Those two arguments are opposed to each other. And my understanding is what, there's several million stones in the Great Pyramid, and to build it in the lifetime of
Khufu.
You'd have to, just using the daylight hours, you'd have to have one go into place every 4 or 5 minutes, something like that, I guess.
It's an impossible task, even if you're just throwing it together without any regard to the precision. Hmm. And they're talking, I mean, most of the conversation on building the pyramid is just placing the blocks. The... there was in Indiana, there are about 33, or used to be 33, limestone quarries. They had the very, very fine limestone, also pneumolitic limestone. But the limestone in the Indiana quarries was used to face the Empire State Building, the Waldorf Astoria in New York. Mm-hmm. And many public buildings used the Indiana limestone. Mel Bucker was the director of the Indiana Limestone Institute, and he was asked to provide an estimate on how long it would take to provide enough limestone to build the Great Pyramid. And he took the information and prepared a quotation and came back with, using all 33 of the limestone quarries in Indiana, assuming no breakdown, tripling the output of those quarries, and assuming that there was no labor strife, no equipment breakdowns, it would take 27 years. And that's using modern equipment.
And that's just to get the raw materials before you put them into place. Yeah.
And so we have so here we have an expert who knows what it takes to get the material out of the ground, using power saws and cranes and, you know, steel tools. And on the other side, we have the Egyptologists with their copper tools and ramps and rollers and men in diapers pulling on hemp ropes. And it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, it doesn't fit. And like you say, this evidence that it doesn't fit is coming from the engineers, you know, people that really understand the problem. And yet the Egyptologists... just don't want to hear that argument, or seem to go silent when that argument comes up. So.
Well, there is a marvelous documentary coming out. I hope they show it in the United States. It's a French production, and I can't say too much about it, but there are, on this documentary, there are architects, engineers, who are coming out and speaking on the, you know, from their expertise on the Great Pyramid. And there's one architect, a bridge builder, designer, who said that he couldn't build the Great Pyramid today. And yet he He was charged with building one of the most famous modern engineering structures in France in the last 10 years.
Oh, good. This should be good. So it's a documentary coming out sometime.
It's a documentary that is produced by a French production team, and I had a preview copy, a confidential copy, and it was I was impressed by the production values that they put into this.
Can you tell us the title of the documentary?
I think it's something about Pyramid Revelations or something like that.
Pyramid Revelations.
But you know, with documentaries, they start out one title, and depending where they show them, the titles can change.
Sure. Just as so many people say, the pyramid might have started off as one type of structure and then changed along the way. But anyway, we're talking with Chris Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
Okay, we're back on the Cosmic Influence. We're talking with Chris Dunn, author of The Giza Power Plant. So we've been talking about some of the mysterious engineering feats that were used to create the pyramids. And
it's not the only one. So one in modern times, you were saying?
Yeah, you have a whole chapter in your book actually dedicated to the Coral Castle in Florida.
Oh, yeah, Ed Leedskalin's work, I guess. Yes.
That's right, yeah.
So what are the what's going on down there?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, and I actually I got criticized for that too, that I would mix modern American feats with ancient Egyptian feats. But so be it. But the reason why I included Leedskalin was because of all the people that I had read who had claimed that they knew how the pyramids of Egypt were built. Ed Leedskalin, to me, seemed to be the only person who made that claim, and he did say that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built. He actually set to work and proved that he knew it. I mean, he didn't build a pyramid, but he moved single-handedly 30-ton block of stone, 22-ton blocks of stone, and over the course of, I think, a 20-year period, he moved about 1,200 tons of coral in Homestead, Florida.
Right, yeah, his front door there that sat on that one pin was 18 tons.
Yeah, there is that's a nine-ton...
Oh, that's
gate,
9 10. Okay.
That is perfectly balanced.
18,000 pounds.
Yeah, 18,000 pounds. And his living quarters, they're all monolithic blocks of coral. And the interesting thing about this guy is that he'd never let anybody watch him work. He was a Latvian immigrant, and he worked as a mason, also a lumberjack, but made his way down to Florida, presumably for health reasons. And when he was going through Florida, he was what people thought he was testing or dowsing, because he was taking a metal rod and sticking it in the ground. And I have, you know, I think what he was doing, but he was looking for a place where the topsoil was fairly shallow, so that he could get to the coral without moving tons of soil above it. And certainly around Florida, just before you start down towards the Keys on Route 1, the topsoil there is very, very shallow. And so he spent his time moving gigantic blocks of coral. And it's a really odd place. If you go there, have you been there, Walter, by any chance?
No, I haven't. I sent my partner, though, and we wrote a chapter on it in my book, Lost Star of Myth and Time.
Yeah. Well, if you go to my website, there is a group of photographs, and it's the last link on the front page at GizaPower.com, Coral Castle. And if you go to the website, you can look at the look at some of the photographs that I had taken. He originally was started out in Florida City, and he had created some of his major pieces there, and that's about 10 miles away from Homestead. But then he moved his pieces over to Homestead, and the legend is, or the story goes, that he had a truck driver who he asked to move the truck, but he would not let the truck driver watch him load the flatbed. He had to leave, and then he would load the flatbed, and the truck driver came back, drove it up Route 1 to the property that he had secured, and then the truck driver had to leave again while Ed unloaded it and set it in place.
Yeah,
but
which leads one to believe Ed's doing something a little out of the norm there.
Well, he was definitely a very interesting character, a very mysterious character.
Yeah, barely 5 feet tall, 100 pounds.
Soaking wet.
Right.
By
himself.
And some of the old photographs that you see of him working, he has these tripods staggered around his place, and they have these little mysterious boxes on the top with wires coming down. And, you know, I speculate in my book that maybe when he said, you know, when he talked about magnetism and individual magnets streaming out of the earth, and how, you know, he knew how to the secrets of how the pyramids were built, he was somehow working with a technique to reduce the weight of the coral.
I suspect he was too, particularly as you read about the higher ages. It's supposed to be an age of magnetism, and I don't think anybody really understands what that means right now. But when I read, I think I've read most of Ed's writings. Even this story about this Sweet 16 seems to be an allegory to me about something else.
And it does. I mean, that book, A Buck in Every Home, is a, if you read it literally, you think, oh man, this guy's off his rocker. Because he, or, you know, he's some screaming chauvinist, but the way he talked about raising a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Raising a child. But the interesting thing about this book is that he leaves enough space for the reader. He says in his author's preface, "Reader, if for any reason you do not like the things I say in this little book, I left just as much space as I use so you can write your own opinion opposite and see if you can do better."
Yeah, it's
and opposite each page is a blank page for you to write whatever you want.
Yeah, it's definitely a metaphor for something else.
I've maintained that, and actually I raised that question in my book. Is this a metaphor for raising a large stone, raising a Sweet 16?
Well, I think we've got something to talk about there. Unfortunately, we're at the end of part one here. So, Chris, we'll take this up in part two. You've been listening to Chris Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt, and The Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to The Cosmic Influence. That was part one of our talk with Chris Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt. And what I liked about that talk was that he's an engineer bringing a knowledge of real hard science and engineering skills to understanding how much the ancients really knew. And that is the type of approach I think it takes to give credibility to this idea that ancient cultures knew more than we knew now.
He's one of the few people out there doing it, taking a unique stand.
Right. So Anyway, we're going to have part two with Chris. We invite you to listen in. And in the meantime, bring on the higher ages.